The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for May 13th, 2017. I hope your week is going well, but there's really no time to chat with you. Well, there is time, but it's in the form of three great conversations. First up this week is a bike shop owner who sells his own brand, Black Mountain Cycles. A few years ago, Brian and I were in California and made a date to stop in and see the proprietor of Black Mountain Cycles, Mike Varley. His shop, which is located in Point Reyes Station in Marin County, right on the coast, is a perfect reflection of Mike and his work. Our conversation covers a wide variety of topics, including the two radio shows for which he's the DJ. Then after a break, journalist Peter Flax joins me to talk about an article he wrote for CyclingTips.com titled "Eligible for Parole After 18 Months in Prison, The Builder, The Bishop, and a Most Violent Crime." Was published on May 5th, just a few days before a scheduled parole hearing for the woman who hit and killed Thomas Palermo in December of 2015. The woman was Heather Cook, the then Episcopal Bishop of Baltimore. Miss Cook was intoxicated, three times the legal limit, in fact, and she was texting. And after hitting the cyclist, who was riding in the bike lane, she fled the scene. After her trial, she was sentenced to 7 years in prison. It's now been 18 months since she was locked up, and her attorney requested an early release by way of a parole hearing. This week, the Baltimore Sun reported that the Maryland Parole Commission denied that request. Commission Chairman David Blumberg said the two commissioners who ruled on the case told him they denied Cook parole in part because she, quote, took no responsibility, end quote, for her actions and displayed a, quote, lack of remorse, end quote, during a 90-minute hearing at the Maryland Correctional Institution for Women in Jessup. I talk with Peter Flax and learn more about his foray into this difficult and terribly sad story. Lastly, my Brian joins me to chat about something that Mike Varley talks about at the beginning of the show. Many years ago, Brian was tasked with finding a solution to a somewhat perplexing shifting problem. Fast forward more than 15 years, and that solution is still being used all over the world. Brian will explain what it is and how it works. So first up, let's talk with Mike Varley from Black Mountain Cycles. Hi, Mike. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today. I think we'll have some fun.
Yes, indeed. That's the plan, right?
It is the plan. It is the plan. You know, when we were in California and visited your shop, it's such a cool little shop. I really like it.
Thank you. It's a shop I pretty much modeled after the first and only other shop I ever worked at, where when you get into the shop, through the main door in the parking area, you walk through the work area.
Right.
And everybody who worked in as a mechanic were also the salespeople.
You're pretty much a one-man band.
Not pretty much. I am a one-man band. Yeah. down to the, you know, the symbols on the knees and, you know,
right, and
the toilet brush in my other hand. And
you took the words right out of my mouth, the toilet brush part. I know about that. I know about mm-hmm. that. So I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your background, because I'm not sure. I mean, I know about you. I know there are a lot of people who know about you, but not all my listeners know about you. Where'd you grow up, and how did you get into cycling? And maybe a little bit of history on your journey to Black Mountain Cycles.
Well, I grew up pretty much after living the first 7 years of my life in Montana. I then pretty much grew up in Southern California. And I was always interested in running. So growing up as a kid, you know, school had little track meets. We'd go on vacations to visit my uncle, and they had kids' track meets. And it was always something that was just fun. But I grew a lot, and my knees just didn't like that. So I couldn't really run anymore. But as I got into college, I started running some more and playing intramural sports like volleyball and basketball. And then by the end of 4 years of college, my knees were just wrecked. And that was 1984. And then the Olympics were on TV. And they were just up the road in Orange County. And I thought, that's it. I'll get a bike. And so I did. And my knee problems went away. And it was awesome because I could go. Like, one of my first rides I did on a bike, I decided to, we lived in a town called Escondido, which is in North San Diego County. And I went to school at UC Riverside, which is about 70 plus miles away. And I thought, well, I'll just ride up there and see my friends. And so I did.
Of course you did.
Yeah. I had an orange with me, and it's like, yeah, no problem. Well, it was a problem because it was a long way, and it was summertime, and I was pretty much looked like a lobster by the end of the day. But that was it didn't turn me back. That was it.
So you didn't actually grow up, you know, riding a bike as a kid and being that.
Well, yeah, we rode bikes as kids, and you know, that's just what in the 60s and 70s, that's what every kid had, a bike.
Yeah, that's true.
And you rode around the neighborhood. We were lucky when I grew up, you know, like in from 7 to 11, we lived behind a park in Goleta, California. And there were trails all over the place and little jumps and stuff, and we rode our BMX bikes all over the place out there. You know, there was no racing scene really then, but we just rode our bikes. We just left for the day, and we were out riding our bikes. And it was a time when you could do that, and it's like, you know, the parents say, go out and play. And you did.
Right. Which today they don't say that, which is really kind of sad. So you said you grew. How much did you grow?
From about my freshman year in high school to sophomore year, I grew about 6 inches.
Oh, so that growth spurt just wreaked havoc with your knees. I get it. So what did you study in college?
Business.
Interesting.
You know, fall back. There was, you know, just like, oh, yeah, you got to go to college and get a degree. And I think I'm the first one in my family to get a 4-year degree. So there wasn't a lot of intimate knowledge about how the system works in college and what you do. But my parents, being not necessarily blue collar, but workers, you know, they worked. They weren't professionals. They weren't academics. But they knew, it's like, the kids have to go to college. And it was the right thing to do, regardless of whether or not I use anything from college. It was an experience where you get to meet people from all over the place, not just from your little town.
Well, clearly you did learn something in college in business. You run your own business.
I think most of that came from working in retail and working on the industry side of things, I guess you could say. So you know how things work and how things are supposed to work and how you might want them to work. You know, you can go to seminars all day long, but whether or not you put it into practice is a different story.
Wow, it's like listening to myself from the outside. That's really cool. I know about that. So how did you become such a great technical mechanic? Everybody says you are the go-to guy for cycling.
I think basically from early on, you know, I had a transistor radio, and so like I wanted to open it up and see how it worked in there. And you know, your bike. You wanted to open it up and see how come these wheels turn around like this. And that's, I think, wanting to know and understand how things work and why they work the way they do is a big thing about that. And just really, every bike I work on, I think, okay, is this bike I would send my kid out on? You know, it's got to be something that I would ride. I have complete trust in it. And working at the first shop I worked at, which was Pacific Coast Cycles down in Carlsbad, California, now Oceanside, we were instilled a sense of pride into, and we called it dialing in a bike. You know, you can get a bike out of a box, put it together, and it works okay. But it's not dialed in. You know, the bearings aren't perfect. The cable lengths aren't perfect. There's little things you can make it be perfect. And it's that little last percent that makes things operate properly. You know, your goal is not to have somebody you built a bike for or you worked on a bike come back soon. You don't want to see them.
Right.
And so that's what I try to do.
Well, it's interesting you say that because, you know, I think all of us who have been in retail have heard people come in and say, I've had my bike to three other shops and they can't seem to figure out what's wrong with it. So it gives you a sense of what else is going on out there in retail. I want to talk a little bit about the Black Mountain Cycle brand. So You actually have come from, I assume you sold production bikes at some point.
Yeah, the shop I worked at, worked there from 88 to 93, and we sold Specialized. We were also probably the biggest, even though we were small, the biggest shop for the mountain bike scene of that era. So we sold Salsas, Bontragers, Ibis. We sold a lot of Marin stuff, Ritchie, Merlin. So we sold high-end mountain bike stuff, all the WTB parts. Later, I would meet, and they would be our distributors for when I was at Haro. But the people from Motocross International, which is a Japanese distributor, after Interbike, they would come to our shop because that's where they could see all that stuff in one small spot. And we became the hub of, you know, greater Southern California area. And I think I'm getting off track here.
That's okay. No, there is no off track. This is just a conversation. We can talk about anything you want, but I'd like to stick with bicycles for just a little bit. We do have another subject to talk about later. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Mike Varley. He is the proprietor of Black Mountain Cycles, and it's pronounced Point Reyes.
Some people say Point Reyes. Some people say Point Reyes. It's, you know, I kind of try to go along with the, you know, original Spanish version and call it Point Reyes Station.
Well, I can tell you it is a lovely spot. It's a beautiful, and your shop is really nice. I like your shop.
Thank you.
It was nice walking into it. It has a great feel to it. All right, tell us about the Black Mountain brand of bicycles.
Well, that started, I worked for 13 years at Haro and finished as the product development manager. I did design and product development and product speccing for, at one time, all of the bikes that we did, BMX, cruisers, road bikes, which we also licensed and then bought the Mozzie brand, mountain bikes. So I've had a hand in designing BMX frames, mountain bike frames, full suspension, road frames, everything. And this all got started. A good friend of mine, Barry Boulanger, who had a shop in Dayton, Ohio called Cycles Gansari, had his own brand. He had the Gansari brand of bicycles. And I thought, that's how you do it. You know, everybody is told in retail, you know, your shop is your brand. Well, it's not really. If you have a big Trek sign out front or Specialized or, you know, a big brand and that's what you have completely in your shop, you're seen as that, you know, that's oh yeah, they're the Trek shop. So having your brand and promoting your brand, that was my goal, and I was inspired by Gary to do that. And I thought, well, you know, why can't a retail bike shop sell create and sell their own brand.
Obviously, it can.
It can, yeah, and it makes perfect sense to me, and that's what I wanted to do, and it's really purely a selfish thing because the bikes I get to do are the bikes that I like to ride, so I'm not selling stuff that is being forced upon me. It's just stuff I like and enjoy, and I'm a bit of a contrarian, I guess you would say.
Maybe.
So if everybody is telling people in the industry that, oh yeah, this is the way to, you know, electronic aero, this is the way to go, it's like I'm going to just kind of pull back and go, well, I kind of like down tube shifters. I kind of like not necessarily toe clips and straps, but I could deal with that if that was all that was available.
Well, you know, I wouldn't call you contrarian so much as someone who just understands what a portion of the market is really going to be happy with. So everybody who follows the carbon fiber route to the carbon fiber end bike is just sort of, you know, I mean, lemmings.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, some people say, you know, because I only work in steel, some people say, oh, you must hate carbon fiber.
No.
But no, it's a good material for certain applications.
Right.
And in fact, I actually love carbon fiber because as the industry completely moves towards that, they're leaving behind all these people who are still attracted to the simplicity and I would say elegance of a steel frame. You know, the thin tubes that look, that just appeals to their aesthetic. And so as, you know, I jokingly say that I love carbon fiber because it's helping my business of selling steel.
Right.
There's a, you know, 3-4 years ago when disc brakes were just starting to come out on cross bikes first, I would get emails all the time, when are you going to do a disc bike? And there was nothing really appealing about the disc bike at that time because it was, I saw it just as a, well, let's just throw disc brakes on this thing. And now I am working on one.
Are you really?
I am.
I was hoping you wouldn't say that, but okay.
I'll explain.
Okay.
But as the whole industry moves away from these simple things, my sales went up because there's a large percentage of people who still want that simple rim brake bike with a steel fork and a steel frame. And I started getting less and less, you know, requests for the disc brake and more sales of the rim brake bikes because people saw that it's like, well, yeah, maybe this works pretty good. And it's not necessarily about working the concept of the rim brake versus the disc brake. There's certain applications that disc brake makes a lot of sense. You know, today, for example, when it's raining out here and you don't want your nice gum wall tires to get all black from rim brake dust, but sales of the rim brake bikes were continuing to grow. It's like I was expecting them, you know, each time I order a lot of rim brake cross frames, for example, I think, okay, this is kind of going to be the last, these frames are going to last me a while, and then all of a sudden, they're gone.
Where are your sales coming from?
They're coming from all over the country.
Wow. How are people finding out about them?
Through... And I don't actively or even inactively pursue what's going on forums, but I get emails from customers or from people who just bought a frame and they say, oh, I saw you on, what are some forums that are bike
related?
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, there are a lot
like,
of them.
Yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head. Paceline, I think, is one.
Oh, I see what you're talking about. Yeah. You're talking about some of the podcasts and some of the other, like Red Kite Prayer and those kinds of things.
No, not those. These are...
Oh, the discussion forums.
Discussion forums.
Oh, okay. I got it.
And people with, you know, anonymous names are posting pictures of their bikes and they're talking about stuff and they're talking about my frames. And that's who are... And thank you to everybody out there who posts something about my frame, because you're the ones that are selling my frames for me, and people are seeing them from all over the country.
What's better?
Yeah. Word of mouth is. I have not advertised. I've not spent a dollar of advertising money from day one.
That's pretty cool. That is pretty cool.
And I think a lot of it really comes down to being honest and not pushing. Every little post I put on my Facebook page or Instagram is not a push about sales.
Right.
It's not, you know, none of the posts, there's some that I do because I feel like I should every once in a while. It's like, oh, by the way, I've got these frames in. Here's the information.
Yeah, but what you do post is occasionally you'll put up a bike, it's already sold, and you'll look at it, and somebody will go, wow, that's really a cool looking bike. And that sells the next however many bikes, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's really selling the idea of riding bikes and, you know, places that you can go to ride bikes. That's really what I'm trying to sell and you know, believe in.
So let's talk 1 second about the mechanical parts. Everybody's talking about electronic stuff and disc brakes. What are you seeing with the equipment that's out there today that absolutely needs a professional's attention? You know, like, don't do this at home?
Well, I think with a lot of things, there's stuff that people can get like 90%, but it's really the professional mechanic that can really get it to that 100% working perfect. It's like there's certain things that you do day in and day out, you know, adjusting a front derailleur. It's like, well, it's not angled perfect. It's working okay, but it's not perfect. So there's not really one thing, I think. And maybe the whole electronic shifting thing is something that might be even easier for the owner of that bike to work on, because I think and I set up a couple of electronic shifting bikes, but it seems like there's you have to have an app to plug into the system so that you can change. I don't have an app.
I don't know if it's an app, but I know you go on Shimano's site and it'll, you know, talk to the bike and the bike will talk to the site, to the Shimano and
right.
Whatever. Yeah, I understand. It doesn't take your finesse with the tools. And I like that hands-on finesse that I see people, well, my husband specifically, you know, adjusting a bike and it's perfect.
Right. And there's certain things that you find and you know, like I think Brian discovered that if you turn the cable anchor washer around and route the cable around a different spot, it changes the leverage ratio and then all of a sudden X becomes compatible with Y.
That is correct. That was his Shimergo solution.
Yeah. And that's brilliant.
That was
yeah,
him.
And
oh,
that,
you're
and
so
that's
smart.
Something that you're not going to learn,
right?
Just, you know, working on one thing one at a time. It's after many times you go, well, what happens here?
Right. Let me remind our listeners again: we're speaking with Mike Varley out in Point Reyes Station, California. He is the proprietor of Black Mountain Cycles. You get to ride a lot because I see that you have a beautiful view. You have this picture that you just put up about. I guess you laid your bike down and took the picture, and it was your morning ride.
Yeah, it was pretty much, you know, a Monday ride, a ride out somewhere. We live, Point Reyes Station is right within next to the Point Reyes National Seashore, which is less than an hour away from San Francisco. And it's less than an hour away, but it's hundreds of miles away from it at the same time. So you can get out there within a couple minutes and be in the wilderness. And it's amazing because even though the park gets 2.5 million visitors a year, you can go out on any given morning and feel like you have it all to yourself. And it's just because of the weather and how it changes so fast here, you can go from, you know, nice sun to just fog and wind and cold and drizzle in a matter of minutes. And so you just seems like you're always prepared for anything because it just could just sneak up on you.
We're going to take a real quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about Mike's other work, which is sort of interesting in my opinion. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're back. We are talking again with Mike Varley out in Point Reyes Station, California. And you have another job besides owning a bike shop. Like, you need another job because that's not a full-time job, right? Tell us about your your radio show. Ha ha ha, you have a radio show like me.
I do. I actually have two radio shows. We, Point Reyes Station is incredibly fortunate that we have a community radio station, an FM full license broadcasting station that broadcasts through an antenna and then through two other transmitters. So we've got three frequencies that we broadcast on to reach West Marin. And it was originally started, oh, many years ago after a big fire that was out here. And there was just no resource for getting information to residents. And so that's how it started, and that's still its main, you know, mission is to properly keep people informed of what's going on. But at the same time, it's a community radio station which is supported wholly by donations and by some government corporate for public broadcasting funds. But it's all volunteers, except for the staff.
Right.
Every programmer on the station is a volunteer.
That's like this station. Same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're either students or citizens of the area who come in and do a show like I do.
Right. And we have pretty much, there are some canned programs that are aired, but it's pretty much live programming from about 8 a.m. till 11 p.m. Just not enough to go, you know, round the clock, but in the variety, I first became aware of it after moving here, and I'm listening to the radio, and I hear, you know, Bob Dylan being played on the radio, and then all of a sudden it's like there's a blues song that's being played, and somebody's in the variety is like, wow, this is, you know, when I worked at the bike shop in the 80s, we had a stereo system in there, and we played a huge eclectic mix of music, and we always wondered why, you know, it's like, we like all this music. Why don't people who are listening to commercial radio like this variety? Why are there not radio stations that are playing this variety that appeal to us? It's like, because, you know, we're us. This is our world. So we reflect everybody.
Well,
right?
And I think that, yeah, and I think that people do want to hear all that different kind of music, and we're getting more of it with college radio like I'm doing. Here we have something called The Heights, which is local people coming from the area coming in and doing individual shows. One's called Beats and Tweets, and one's Retro Radio, which plays stuff from the 60s. And
mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think everybody, yeah. And even the kids today are listening to stuff we listened to 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And so I was actually listening to the radio, and a friend of mine was subbing for somebody and called and asked if I had any Elvis Presley CDs, because she didn't have any CDs of Elvis because it was his birthday. And I said, well, yeah, I do. It's like, well, come on down to the station. So I went there, bought some stuff, and it's like, wow, this is pretty fun. And from there, it grew into doing, I have a show called Bakersfield and Beyond, where we, being in liberal Marin County, it's very different than conservative Bakersfield, but we have a show about the music that came out of Bakersfield in the 50s and 60s, and then tacking on the Beyond part, we go into musicians who were influenced by that sound, and we get to play, as we say, country music for people who hate country music.
Right. So do you take requests on your show?
Oh, we'll take requests, sure. Oh,
okay, so you are on live. Okay.
It's live, yeah. Yeah, it's all live. And then the other show I do, I jokingly mentioned this friend of mine is also the station manager now, but I joked to her that I thought, you know, if I ever have a solo radio show, I think the name could be Running with Scissors.
Oh, that's one of my favorite comments. I make that comment all the time to people.
Yeah, and I thought, this would be a good name. And next thing I know, it's like, okay, your time slot is 8:30 to 10. Running with, it's like, but so that show, instead of, is kind of a 360 away from the country music, where it's well, I'll play rock and punk and blues and soul and R&B and funk and, you know, everything that I have pretty much in my record collection.
Well, I guess that's the question. You own all that music then?
Yes.
Wow.
Pretty much everything that I play on my shows, I own. The station does have a very large library of CDs, and one could technically go in and do anything, you know, from blues sections, classical, rock, the whole, you know.
Right.
There's a lot of singer-songwriter type stuff, reggae, funk. So it's you could go in and do anything you wanted to with the music in the library at the station.
So is the show streaming or is it strictly local live?
Oh, no, it's live, local. It streams as well.
What's the station?
It's KWMR, and the website's kwmr.org.
That's really cool. Really
cool.
Yeah,
and music shows are archived for 2 weeks afterwards.
Oh, so somebody could go back and listen.
Oh, there's lots of ways to listen.
Yeah, no kidding. So when you're not working or writing or playing music, what are you doing, as if you had any extra time?
I'm working or writing or
oh, okay,
playing
fine.
Music, yeah.
Okay. What's your favorite food?
Something that fills me up.
Good answer, actually, but that could be a lot of things. So is there anything special?
And I've never, growing up, as an adult, I've never had favorites where, you know, you hear somebody say, oh, she's my favorite movie star. It's like, really? How do you judge that? And why? So I've never had favorites. You know, going to Taiwan for so many times when I worked at Haro, we ate all kinds of food, you know, and you can't be picky about anything.
Right.
So I'm pretty much okay. Like I said, as long as
it fills you up.
I could eat the same thing every day. It serves a purpose of letting me be able to go ride my bike. You know, it's like gas for your car. Your car doesn't care where you get your gas at.
That's true. That's very true. Very interesting philosophy. I have to say, even though you are not an engineer by training, the heck you're not an engineer. You think like an engineer. And do you have any pets?
No pets.
Oh, just bikes.
Just bikes.
Yeah. What's your favorite bike these days?
I have actually been riding a prototype I'm working on that, as we roll into the disc brake thing.
Right.
The concept of those, of what WTB labeled Road Plus.
Oh, nice.
Which is 650B by 47, 48 size tires.
Yep.
And that, I've got a prototype that's designed around those tires. And that, I have to say, is one of the funnest bikes I've ridden in a long time. The volume of that tire is still very fast on the road. You can go off-road. You can hit. I went for a ride last night with Sean Walling from Soulcraft Cycles, and he was on his saying that the 650B by 47 tire that he built for NABS a few years ago. And we're riding along these country roads that are just pockmarked with potholes and patchwork, and they're rough. They're farm roads. They're, you know, trucks, and they're just getting used heavily. And we don't have to worry about our line. We don't have to weave in and out around the patchwork cement and asphalt. We just go over everything. And you barely notice that stuff. And then combining that with the disc brakes, because that diameter wheel is roughly the same as a 700 by 30 or 32, you could change the characteristics of the bike and it's capable of by simply putting on a different wheel set without affecting any handling. And that kind of concept is really appealing to me.
And when will that bike be available?
It's probably a year out.
Okay.
Hopefully sooner, because I think it's cool. I want to get some more.
Yeah. You can only ride one at a time, Mike.
That's true.
That's true.
I have, I think, probably over 30, maybe 40 bikes. And they range from, it's all pretty much vintage stuff, from the 80s and 90s mountain bikes to pretty much 80s road bikes.
And we use the word vintage. Doesn't that feel weird?
I know it does. Uh-huh. It's like, it's just, you know, they're just my bikes.
Right. Well, it's been wonderful to talk with you, catch up, and we'll get back out there sometime. You know, I love visiting that area of California. It's my favorite. And I appreciate you talking with me, DJ Mike.
All right. Thank you, Diane.
All right. Take care. Have a good day.
Thanks. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Mike Varley joined me from Black Mountain Cycles in Point Reyes, California. Interesting guy. I've known him for a while. Really appreciate his philosophy and the work that he does. We're going to take a break. We'll be back. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and it's off to L.A. to speak with journalist Peter Flax. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Great to be here. How are you?
I'm good. How's L.A.?
Great.
Still riding like a commuter in L.A.?
Yeah, every day. Every day. I had to leave a bike at work the other night. So this morning I came in with that new IKEA bike and did a combination of metro and bike. So changed it up, but on my bike every day.
I forgot that you got one of the little bike in a bag IKEA bikes, that the bag is bigger than the bike or something like that. I remember that. How is that bike? Do you like it?
It's not a love affair. It's like got a lot of good ideas, but I won't be surprised if a year from now there's a different bike at IKEA that's better than this one. It's like a great idea for IKEA to sell a $400 bike and not in love with this one.
Well, let's talk about the article you wrote for Cycling Tips on May 5th. It was an extensive, in-depth article titled Eligible for Parole After 18 Months in Prison, The Builder, The Bishop, and a Most Violent Crime. And it was a most violent crime. It's all about the death of Tom Palermo at the hands of the then Episcopal Bishop of Baltimore, Heather Cook. Tell us a little bit of background on your story, why you wrote it, how you got to the people you spoke with for the story, and what you came away with after all your research.
Right. So I think like a lot of people, I became aware of what happened to Tom Palermo the day that it happened, right after Christmas in 2014. And through Google alerts, I read about most cases in the United States where someone gets while they're riding a bike, gets hit and killed by a hit and run driver. But even in looking at it from that point of view, this was just a crazy, dramatic story where a woman who was a high-ranking Episcopal bishop who was hammered hit and killed him and left the scene twice. And then it turned out that she had this previous DUI that was really dramatic. So it became kind of like a poster child case of like the worst case scenario of how a cyclist could die. And so just to have been following that case and thinking about it since the day it happened. And at some point, as I mentioned in the story, I actually sent a letter to Mrs. Cook while she was in prison and got a letter back and sort of wound up getting a little bit personally involved with her on that level, which just deepened my interest in writing about it sometime.
Yeah, she's not a very forthcoming woman, evidently. One of the things I found most disturbing about the story is that not only did she have prior convictions, but that she's still, to date, has never said she's sorry. She shows virtually no remorse and sort of wants to take on this role as your pastor or something. What do you make of the kind of character that, is supposed to be, so above this kind of thing? How do you think this all happened?
Yeah, it's hard to process it all. There's on the day of her sentencing, she did offer a few sentences of remorse and an attempt at least to take personal responsibility for what she did. But it felt even like her, saying what she expected her responsibility to be in that moment when a judge was about to issue a sentence. I think for the most part, she struck me as a sick person, you know, a person struggling with alcohol and struggling to maintain this role as a leader of a religious community and being just so self-involved in that struggle that it's hard to lift her head up from that and realize the harm she's caused and how she could be communicating a different level of empathy for people than she is. I do feel some pity for her.
I understand that. And I guess if you can step back and not be, you know, kind of sucked into the horror of the whole thing, yeah, you could hopefully see where she's kind of a sorry case. What I found interesting is that the Episcopal Church evidently did know of her previous DUI. So I'm wondering what the vetting process was and how she suddenly made it to this super high position within the community.
Yeah, I'm guessing that the leaders in the Episcopal Church that overlooked her first DUI, that they feel awful because I think they presumed that it was just this one-off problem that they misread. Although I would, you know, for anybody who, she got pulled over with a 0.27 blood alcohol level, which is just actually close to death. And so I would think that anybody that knew of somebody in that kind of trouble would take aggressive action. And I feel like the church just kind of took a hands-off approach to it. And it is really disturbing to me that the people who voted her into that post as bishop largely just had no idea she had this problem. It would be like a political candidate having a red flag like this and, you know, the Democratic or Republican National Committee deciding that it wasn't in the public interest to know that. That's disturbing.
It is disturbing. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Peter Flax. We're talking about the Thomas Palermo case. He was tragically killed right after Christmas in 2015.
No, I think it was 2014, right at the end of 2014.
Okay. I've got that date wrong. Well, at any rate, it's horrible. He left two children, and he left kind of in his wake this man who came across the crash. I don't want to call it an accident because it wasn't. It was a crash. Who was that man? And you wrote a lot about him, and you obviously spoke with him.
Yeah, I mean, that was I saw his name mentioned in a couple of old newspaper articles, and you know, for my day job, I'm an editor at the Hollywood Reporter, so I've gotten a lot of practice to just track people down and get them on the phone. And you know, I found this gentleman and had an hour long talk with him that was super fascinating and sad. That it was he was just out for a ride. It was, as I mentioned the story, it was just this crazy, unseasonably warm day. It was a couple days after Christmas, and suddenly the temperature just had gone up, 20 or 25 degrees above what it had been, and it was like a nice fall day. And so everybody who lived in Baltimore went out for a bike ride, and so this guy was like nearly wrapped up with his ride, coming up this little hill, and just came upon Thomas Palermo in the street, and there were a few high school kids who had just driven by and seen it, but he was essentially the first person to clamber up to Thomas and try and render aid, and has that story. And then after he had been at the scene for a while, Heather Cook drove past the scene in her car, and he wound up chasing her down on his bike. So he had, a pretty dramatic story to tell of like being the first one to see Palermo on the ground and then being involved in chasing the person who had killed Tom.
Yeah, it was interesting that she fled the scene twice, I think, and came back.
Yeah.
Yeah, your story about his name was Mancur.
Yeah, Lyon.
Mancur Leon or Lyon. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just an interesting name, but that he actually got into her gated community and tried to track her down.
Yeah, yeah. He like, you know, the security guard was like, "You're not allowed in here." And he was like, "Well, I just saw this woman's car. I believe she, you know, was just involved in a fatal hit and run, and just, you know, sort of went around the speed bump in the gate and just started looking for the car." So it was a pretty dramatic situation to be in.
That was a ballsy move, but good for him, you know. The ex-bishop's sentence was originally 7 years, and it seems like a short time to me. You quoted cycling attorney Peter Wilborn as saying, "The punishment never seems like enough. It just never seems like enough. More time in prison won't bring Tom back. That's why, as a lawyer, I want to define victory beforehand and discuss it with the family. You need to know what you are actually going for. In a case like this, I'd say a conviction and some jail time." I'm sorry, I'd say a win is a conviction and a jail time. So I don't know. What, is there a win here at all?
Yeah, I think, as again, as someone who follows all of the cyclists who get killed in these circumstances, that in many cases people are struck down in a way that seems criminal to me, where the driver's able to just throw up their hands and say, you know, I didn't see them. It was an accident. And despite the best attempts of an attorney and the family, they're never even able to get the system to look at that crash as a criminal act. So in this case, at least everyone just knew that this was a crime and a serious one. And, you know, even if Bishop Cook had been granted early parole, she would have spent over a year and a half in a real big boy prison, and that's something. But I think that, like, the larger point of what Peter, that attorney, and I were talking about was this sense of, like, once you really get into it, it's not like there's some number of years or months where everyone's just going to feel whole about what happened. That if Heather Cook spends 18 months in prison or 4 years in prison or 7 years in prison, Tom Palermo is still dead, and we're all just going to feel queasy about justice. And, you know, I think he felt very strongly that he wanted her to spend more than 18 months in prison. But the idea was just that, like, there's not going to be some magic number where we all feel good about it.
Do you think that this case is high profile enough to actually make a difference overall?
I just don't know. I mean, if to take a slight tangent, you know, I think that one of the interesting things about how these cases are being adjudicated is that, you know, someone gets hit and killed while they're riding their bike. There tends to be two cases that spring into action simultaneously. There's a criminal case and a civil case. And that in a lot of these situations, the system right now tends to just try and have the bulk of justice meted out through the civil case. And that happened here to the extent it's hard for me to know precisely, but there was a civil case where Tom's widow and his family had a different lawyer and were going for justice that had a monetary settlement, and that happens while the criminal case is happening. And so in a lot of cases, judges and the system just let people get a big settlement through a civil case and de-emphasize the need to find justice through the criminal process. And I'd like to see that change. I think it's really hard for me to get my head around how people who kill people with a car are any less liable to face jail time than people who kill with any other weapon. But right now, a lot of times, people are just able to pursue these huge civil judgments, and that's kind of how they resolve these cases.
Yeah, I think that, and I know that that's how that happens. There's the civil and the criminal. To me, it seems like the criminal case should be the high-profile case. It should be the one that everybody wants to see what's going to happen to the person who was so careless or so, you know, uncaring.
Right.
Or in her case, just completely obliterating.
Right.
I don't understand that, but I'm wondering if there's a way to parlay some of the criminal cases to the forefront and begin turning that into some sort of a campaign that people can take a look at and say, it's the same thing with the texting and driving, and it's the same, you know, drinking and driving. You know, hitting a child is no different from hitting Thomas Palermo. So
right.
I'm just not sure how that works.
I mean, I think that my answer to that is just that's exactly why I wrote this story. And I think that people who care about the issue just need to do what they can to get these stories out there and read. And, you know, I certainly think in Maryland that with all the continued attention this case has gotten, that the district attorneys and judges have more of an awareness there, at least, of just the public sentiment. And you know, everybody in those professions is just aware of public opinion. And if they sense that more and more people look at these cases outraged as murders, then they're more likely to treat them that way in the legal system.
Well, that would be nice. The article again is eligible for parole after 18 months in prisons. The Builder, the Bishop, and A Most Violent Crime. It was by Peter Flax for cyclingtips.com. It's an excellent article. Get yourself a cup of coffee and sit down and read it if you are interested. I thought it was fascinating. I certainly passed it around, and I know it got passed around from there. Thank you so much for writing it. I really appreciate it.
No, it was a moving experience for me. It was definitely, you know, it's not an easy read, and having those conversations with people who were close to Tom was hard, but I feel strongly about it, and I appreciate you shedding a little light on it, too.
Well, hopefully the next time she asks for parole, it will be denied again. She is in for allegedly a 7-year sentence. Most people are saying she's probably going to serve half of it. And again, it isn't about the time. It's about showing what can happen if you make this kind of decision in your life.
Yeah, I think that the way I understood what the parole board decided was that she's no longer going to be considered for early parole, and that only credits that she can earn for good behavior will shorten the sentence. I believe 2019 is the earliest she can get out, but there will be no more hearings for early parole. She's going to serve the full sentence minus whatever credits she earns for good behavior.
That's actually a positive thing. Peter, thanks so much for talking with me today. You do great work. I love reading it. And we'll talk again.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
Good talking to you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Peter Flax joined me from his office in Los Angeles talking about the Thomas Palermo case. Always an interesting conversation. So we're going to take a real quick break. We'll be back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're going to talk with Brian. My Brian, about one of the comments that Mike Varley made during our conversation, and sort of tell you how it all happened. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and as promised, I have Brian here in the studio with me. Hey, how are you?
I'm all right.
Yeah, same as you were a little bit ago?
Just a little bit ago.
Yeah, just a little bit ago. So Mike Varley made a comment about a solution you came up with, and it's been many years. I still have this recollection of you sitting on a stool staring at a bike. Tell us how you backed into that solution and what the necessity for it was.
Well, what you're referring to is, you know, Mike called it the Shimurgo solution, which, to clarify, I did not come up with that, the name.
That is true. Who did? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I think it was, I don't remember.
Wasn't it some guy in England or something?
Maybe. It might have been, I think it was off of the Tandem at Hobbs list, maybe, something like that.
Oh,
just people
okay.
Just started calling it that. No, folks don't know what that means. It's, you know, Shimurgo. It's a combination of Shimano and Campy's Ergo power controls. So what I did is I combined the Campy shifter and got it to control a Shimano 9-speed derailleur, the Campy 10-speed shifter.
But this was for the front derailleur?
No, this was for the rear.
Oh, it was for the rear.
Yeah, for the rear.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what was the problem?
I don't remember what prompted me to start working on the project. What I do remember at the beginning was working on it on my own, sitting down and attaching some calipers to different cable systems, the Shimano 8-speed, Shimano 9-speed. This was before 10-speed. Campy had just come out with 10-speed. Campy 9-speed, Campy 10-speed, and measuring, taking, I still have the spreadsheets of all the measurements and what the the graphs I plotted to try and figure out what the differences were in the cable pull ratios for each shifter in hopes of making some sort of a cam adapter to allow me to control any shifter, any derailleur I wanted using maybe any shifter I wanted. And I don't think it was too long after that before our friends, you remember Casey and Melissa?
Of course.
Yeah, they came in and wanted us to build a tandem for them, but they both preferred Campy shifting. And as we know, the shifting experience is really about what the shifter in your hands. It doesn't, as long as the bike shifts gears, it doesn't really matter what the drivetrain is. You just want it to shift. But in terms of the ergonomics and your experience of what it's like to shift a bike, that's the shifter in your hands, how comfortable it is, you know, riding down the road and how the shifter operates. And some of us prefer the operation of a Campy shift lever.
Well, and I know that Casey did because he tested everything.
Well, Melissa, as I remember, was already a Campy rider, and we had gotten Casey into cycling. And so now he was riding Campy too. And they said, well, we want a tandem, but under one condition, we have to have Campy on it. Well, at this time, Campy had, this was a few years after Campy had dropped their mountain bike, the brief period that they made mountain bike components. So all the tandems at the time, we needed triple cranks and long-range derailleurs. And the only way to do that at the time was with Shimano. So the only solution we could think of was to find some way to shift a Shimano wide-range drivetrain, you know, mountain bike drivetrain that we were using on tandems, and be able to shift that with a Campy shifter.
And so I know you did all these calculations. You sat in front of this bike. It was such an interesting experience watching you, observing what you were doing. And you suddenly had an aha moment.
Well, so I suppose you could call it that.
Yeah.
What I learned from, you know, my hope in doing these experiments was to plot the graphs and figure out what the differences in slope were so I could see what the differences in the controls inside, you know, the ratios of the shifting barrels inside the controls were. And the graphs were interesting. I don't remember details, but the slopes were different, as to be expected. But I kind of remember one of them, I don't remember which, had one was fairly linear and one was had more of a curve to it. Which clearly makes it very difficult. You know, the cam would have to have some kind of eccentricity to it. It would have to be off center, or maybe even have maybe an elliptical shape to it to pull that off. So I put a Shimano 9-speed cassette on a bike with a Shimano 9-speed derailleur with a Campy 10-speed control. Using the graphs, I could see that the 10-speed control, the slope of the graph that I got off the Campy 10-speed control was pretty similar to what I was seeing on the Shimano 9-speed, but it had a little bit different shape to it. So I thought, well, I'll just try shifting that combination and see what happens. So I put the bike together and tried shifting it, and I could see it was shifting fast at one end of the range. I don't remember which range, but let's say it was shifting fast at the high end and slow at the low end. It might have been the opposite. I don't remember. So it was overshifting in some gears and shifting properly in the middle range of the range and then undershifting at the other end. So I thought, well, if I can make some change to the way the cable is pulled at the derailleur, change the leverage so that it moves faster in one place and slower at the other place, you know, the parallelogram of the derailleur, then it would probably work. So that's what you remember, is me sitting there thinking about, okay, how am I gonna make this work? I could make a little part and attach it. But there's a little hooked washer that the cable gets clamped under, and I thought, well, what if I just rotate that and move the cable around it? It would actually change the leverage. And I tried it and it worked. And it was kind of, I remember it being like,
I do
this,
remember.
This really can't be, it can't be this easy. This is not, you know, so we tried it and we yanked on it. You know, you stretch the cables and we pretty much did everything we could to make it not work. And the more we let the cable settle in and adjusted it, it worked. I mean, I've done several since. My own bikes are built this way,
right.
Couple of them. We ended up building our own tandem this way for many years. And it ended up working, you know, shifting at least as well as the full Shimano stock system. It shifted really, really well.
So can you tell I'm married to an engineer, by the way? So that is how the Shimergo solution happened in our shop. We are going to bring Brian back for a variety of these kinds of conversations he obviously thinks about these things much more deeply than I do and much more intelligently than I do. But we thought,
I don't know about that.
Yeah, well, we thought we would just share that experience since Mike mentioned it in his conversation. Can people still find that solution somewhere?
You know, I don't know. Somewhere I have the original article I wrote. I threatened years ago to take it down, and boy, that the feedback was like, don't do that. We still want to do that. You know, people still need to know. Well, since then, you know, the past 5-10 years, drivetrains have changed in a direction that it becomes much less necessary.
Unless you're a retro grouch and just want to do
it. Oh, sure. You know, it still works really well, but those old Shimano 9-speed derailleurs that work that well, they're tough to find anymore.
Wow, I'm sorry to have ended my conversation with Brian so abruptly, but he needed to get off to the shop and I needed to get ready for my conversation with Peter. I hope you enjoyed our show for this week. I'd like to thank Mike Varley, Peter Flax, and of course my husband Brian. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist. And in the meantime, remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.